Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Askins. Because this is a TJAG certified case, the government will argue first. So, Major Nguyen, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? And Captain Creighton, are you prepared to argue on behalf of Sergeant Askins? Because cross appeals and so forth, there's no good way to refer to him, so I'll refer to him as Sergeant Askins. Very well, then, please proceed.
Apologies, Your Honor. We believe it was the other way around.
Well, because it is TJAG certified case, it is our tradition to have the government argue first. It goes to the issue of the complexity of who's appellant, who's appellee, and so forth. Major Nguyen, are you prepared?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major V. Nguyen, and together with Colonel Richard Guarini, we represent the United States.
Major Nguyen, could you just speak in a... Yes, thanks.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Your Honor, if we could please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
When appellant agreed to waive all waivable motions, he agreed to waive even multiplicity and the statute of limitations if they applied. Now, if this court nevertheless disagrees, then his convictions were not multiplicious because they were based on factually distinct acts, and the statute of limitations did not apply because the United States was still at war in 2014 and 2016 when appellant stole the explosives. The standard of review for waiver and for statutory interpretation is de novo, and for the CCA's interpretation is abuse of discretion. Turning first to the issue, the specified issue and the certified issue, this court can find affirmative waiver based on U.S. v. Malone as well as in Gladue. Here, his counsel affirmatively waived the right when, in response to the military judge's advisal about all motions dismissed, he stated the defense had no more pretrial motions on JA 36 and 66. Similarly, based on U.S. v. Gladue, this court had found that with the inclusion of the waive all waivable motions provision in the guilty plea, the words were unambiguous that all meant all. And so when he personally waived it, it was unnecessary for him to include multiplicity explicitly in that provision. We have those same facts here. We also believe that it applies to both contested and uncontested portions of trial because the plea agreement made no distinction. This would be different if these were bifurcated proceedings so that there might be a reason to doubt whether that provision applied. But the guilty plea clearly contemplated both parts of the court's martial, and without that distinction, this court should also find that the meaning remains unambiguous.
So let's kind of break this down into its component parts. And I'd actually like to jump forward to, because you're talking about the plea agreement and it affecting the domestic violence specifications as well as statute of limitations. I'm just wondering whether the TJAG certified issue is actually framed correctly.
Yes, Your Honor.
So TJAG poses the question to us whether the CCA erred when it found that the offenses were multiplicious. But isn't that the question that would be posed to us if Askins had preserved the issue?
Yes.
And here it's a situation where even defense indicates that if you get past waiver, it was forfeited. So aren't we really wrestling with the issue of plain error view? And doesn't that mean we're looking at what the military judge did? Not the CCA, not whether the CCA erred, but whether the military judge plainly erred.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct. However, you know, as this court found in U.S. v. Cook, the question of merits is not the same question as waiver. So first we move to the question of waiver. If this court finds that there was mere forfeiture, then the court does analyze for plain error.
Yes. So if that's the case, could you please give us a relatively succinct argument about why, in that instance, if we're dealing with plain error and looking at what the military judge did, that the military judge, assuming that the military judge erred, that it was not clear or obvious error?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to multiplicity, there we would be looking at what is the framework for facially duplicative specifications. As we argued in Ford, we believe that the controlling cases are Blockberger, Pauling, Coleman, and Campbell, so that the framework analysis is first, is it factually distinct acts, and then second is congressional intent. If this Court disagrees, then we're asking again for this Court to explain the relationship between Forrester and Blockberger. Are they mutually exclusive tests, or do they go one after the other, and in which order? Key to this case, though, if Forrester applies, is the concept of same or different statutes. Here, Article 128B has five alternate phrases. Each of them require different elements. They have differing punishments if there's underlying, depending on the underlying conduct. And if we follow the logic in Mendoza, then they're alternate theories of liability. Now, we argued in Ford, and we are again arguing here, that 128 and 128B are clearly different statutes because these offenses were under 128 and Congress decided it was not enough, and Congress created an entirely new provision. So at the very least, 128B1 violent offense incorporating assault consummated by battery 128 is different than 128B5 strangulation. Now, if this Court disagrees and 128 applies and Rushing's continuous course of conduct applies, then nevertheless, the time and impulse were not correctly analyzed. Here, this order of events was that the appellant's wife threatened to separate and divorce from him. And then he lunged at her, attacked her, and slammed her into the dog kennel. Then there was a break because he had time to put away their dog. She had time to go to the kitchen, pick up her belongings, and then go towards the door and threaten to report him to the unit. Then the second assault happens, and coupled with the second slam into the breaker box was strangulation. So for timing, we believe that that was a significant enough break, that these are different acts. And for impulse, it's different because first he feared that his marriage was ending, and then second he feared that his career was ending.
Thompson, can we go back to the waiver issue? Let's suppose that there had been no pretrial agreement in this case, and that we just came up to the point where the military judge says, now how do you plead before you plea? Do you have any motions? And he says, I have no motions. And then we proceed to the trial. Would he have waived his multiplicity argument in that case?
It would certainly be not as strong as the facts in this case. There would be reason to doubt whether he meant for it to apply. But in U.S. v. Malone, the presumptions were that we all understood we were going into a guilty plea, and so what he intended to do was to waive all waivable motions. We also presumed knowledge in that case based on the savings clause. So if the plea agreement didn't include it here either, there would also be that we wouldn't necessarily have the same facts to demonstrate that there was clearly established knowledge of the right. We'd have to look to something else in the record. But here we have the savings clause, we have the unrebutted presumption of counsel, we have no changes on appeal claiming that he was unaware, that he was incorrectly advised, and even the characterization at trial, neither the government nor defense characterized this as one single episode. They understood them to be two separate events.
Counsel, suppose he had said, look, I want the specification 1 and 2 are multiplicious. Wouldn't the government have said, well, wait a minute, Your Honor, it's not ripe yet, because he might be found guilty of 1 and not guilty of 2, or guilty of 2 and not guilty of 1, in which case there's no multiplicity issue at all. But how can he waive it before it's ripe, before there isn't really a multiplicity issue, is there, until the proof has come in?
Because, Your Honor, the issue of the merits is separate from whether the waiver happened at all. Waiver, what is required is sufficient knowledge of the nature of the right that's being waived, not the chances of success. So as this court consistent in U.S. v. Cook, this court had explained that it is incumbent upon the defense counsel to preserve the right, even if it's potentially meritorious. And this makes sense, even if you look at the role of defense counsel, because when defense counsel is advising on a right, there's three things that they could potentially say within the scope of competent counsel: that the right applies, that the right doesn't apply, or that the right might apply. And two of those answers would be correct.
Counsel, can I ask another question? Let's suppose that we're unsure whether there's a waiver, but we agree with the government that there is no multiplicity. Can we just proceed to decide the multiplicity issue, or are we required to decide the waiver issue first?
Your Honor, in this case, I believe that Your Honor, I'm not sure that piercing is still available to the court under the current rules. But if it is, then the Army had done so if there was some military reason to justify it. But I'm happy to brief that further, Your Honor.
Counsel, I have a question. You described the two incidents before the kennel incident and the breaker box incident, but specification one just describes strangling, and it doesn't mention either incident.
Yes.
But you seem to suggest that it deals with the second incident, the breaker box incident. How do we know that from the charge sheet?
So from the charge sheet, that would not be that's not something that's plain on its face. But when you're looking at facially duplicative specifications, my understanding is that we can take into account what's said at trial. And so at trial, we have the testimony providing that she was slammed into the dog kennel. She does say on cross-examination that she was strangled, but there's no separate evidence of a loss of circulation or breath or other requirements for strangulation. At most, that was assault consummated by battery. And later on, when she testifies about the second event, trial counsel does ask her to explain what happened. She said that she struggled to breathe. So we have her explaining the second incident, hands around the neck, on JA 42 to 43, and her strangling to breathe 44 to 45. So we do know that there was only a single strangulation in this case, Your Honor.
And that's just based off the fact that she didn't give the testimony. I mean, she described it as a strangulation in her own testimony.
Yes, Your Honor. Layperson witnesses may use legal terms in ways that are incorrect. Many times witnesses may describe what they're feeling as choking versus strangulation, for example. So because if we were to do a legal sufficiency review of this, there's no evidence of a struggling to breathe, circumstantial or direct, we would not consider the first hand on her throat to be strangulation.
Because it seems like the government chose to charge this as there were two incidents, but the way they didn't charge it as incident one, as incident two, they charged it as two acts of strangulation in one specification, one or two, and then one or two acts of slamming in a second specification. It seems like from the government's own charging scheme, they seem to believe that these were the same course of conduct.
We don't have enough information in the record to come to that conclusion. It's equally likely that the government, in its discretion, decided that those were two similar acts under 128B1, properly charged together, versus strangulation under 128B5 as its own.
Counsel, based upon your answer to Judge Hardy's first question, it goes back to Judge Maggs's question with regards to how the appellant would have been put on notice of the multiplicity or the potential for multiplicity when, as you just admitted, that looking at the charge sheet, it wasn't facially duplicative. So going back to that, how would the accused preemptively waive the multiplicity issue if the multiplicious nature of it did not come to light until the testimony?
Because, Your Honor, multiplicity is one of the rights that would be reviewed as part of the strategy the defense counsel would do. And so, again, if the facts did raise multiplicity, he did have the right to raise a motion to dismiss because of the savings clause in this case, but he did not do so. So we view that to be a deliberate decision that the defense counsel made on behalf of his client. Turning to the granted issue, unless the court has further questions on multiplicity, like multiplicity, the statute of limitations is a waivable motion, and we do not believe that it needs to be explicitly referenced in order for it to be waived. We believe that U.S. v. Thompson is not controlling, especially in a guilty plea case, because it did not meaningfully consider the fact that the RCM changed so that the language required an affirmative advisal obligation on the military judge versus now a condition precedent, which is that he must be unaware. Thompson relied on 1951 cases, which we learned recently that was before guilty pleas became commonplace in the military justice system. It was before the trial judiciary was established in 1968 and before the defense counsel, trial defense services were established in 1980. And so with the statute of limitations being a congressionally granted right, how can it be that multiplicity need not be referenced in that provision, but statute of limitation does? We believe that Tunnell and Troxell, in their simple sentences, took into account defense counsel's role, so that the military judge's affirmative duty to establish knowledge does not displace defense counsel's primary role of doing the same. Examples where he might have been unaware of this right is if he was pro se, or if he had said to the court at any time, whether in his post-trial matters or on appeal, that he was unaware of the right and he would not have pled to it if he had known. And there is also no objective evidence in the record demonstrating that he was unaware. We actually have the opposite in this case, because not only did his defense counsel represent to the military judge that the statute of limitations may not apply and he may be liable for offenses as early as 2011, but he references Rivas Chivas, which is the Army Court precedent, with respect to the same right. And it does not make sense that his counsel would not advise him of the right in that case.
So imagine when you just referred to the fact there's nothing in the post-trial material indicating that in fact, he did not know. Is that an oblique reference on your part to no IAC claim?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, there is no IAC claim, so you can presume there's competent counsel, and a competent counsel would not withhold such important information from his client. And again, we also have the waive all waivable, which again, need not make explicit reference.
Counsel, at least from your colleagues' briefs, I assume they're going to get up in a few minutes and tell us that even if they were aware of the statute of limitations issue could have been raised, defense counsel at trial misunderstood it. Can I get your response now to that argument?
They misunderstood the right. Well, we do not have, first of all, defense counsel was very competent, and defense counsel understood that the statute of limitations does not apply. So we disagree that they had somehow misunderstood, and there's no independent evidence in the record that it's incorrect. But again, the waiver is with respect to the nature of the right. It doesn't mean that that they needed to have had a meritorious argument. So he had eliminated even the possibility of raising it by including the waive all waivable affirmative reference, a response to the military judge.
Does the beginning of your answer there again go to the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Yes.
And that the failure to file an ineffective assistance of counsel claim puts this court at a disadvantage in terms of knowing what was really going through the mind of trial defense counsel and through the mind of the accused at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. But ultimately, if this court does find that it wasn't waived and it was mere forfeiture, it still was not plain, and we would point you to the 1991 CMA case, U.S. v. Moore, as a contrast, because while he did not contest these charges, he persisted in his plea, so there was, at the very least, no prejudice, even if there was error. Turning to the granted issue with respect to time of war, When Congress passed Article 43F, Congress intended to toll the statute of limitations for certain offenses during the time of war. This Court's predecessor has established that there is a test for de facto versus de jure wars. And the factors that came out of it in the Bancroft case were a list of non-exhaustive descriptive indicia of war, that none of which are dispositive. And because no war will ever be the same, and with modern warfare changing in its nature capabilities, the Army Corps, the CCA's application for analyzing the trigger clause should be based on the nature and character of the military action at the time.
Major, may I ask a question, and I think this relates to the amicus brief by Mr. Young. Who has the burden of proof with respect to those factors, especially when it wasn't raised at trial and so there is no real proof? And then related to that question, can this Court or the Army CCA take judicial notice of declarations by the President and others with respect to the war, even if there is no proof that's entered? So the first question is, who has the burden of proof with respect to those factors? And the second question is, can those facts be found by judicial notice?
I believe that the government would still have the burden of proof. Yes, this Court would be able to take judicial notice of commonly known facts such as declarations. Yes, Your Honor. So
why would the government have the burden of proof? It's a defense motion to dismiss for statute of limitations. It's not raised. It's not part of the case at all. Why would the government have the burden of proving it?
On appeal, the defense did raise the statute of limitations. I see, Your Honor.
We can think about it.
apologize. The trigger analysis asks what the United States was engaged in, not the consequences of it. In other words, the military action needs to have a certain scope, duration, and intensity as to clearly distinguish it from what war is not: isolated acts of terrorism, banditry, and law enforcement actions. But Congress did not require a total war, a minimum number of casualties, nor conditions to be so disruptive that they inhibit support functions and entirely prevent us from conducting courts-martial. In this case, the central question is whether hostilities had terminated at the time that the appellant had stole the explosives, because the statute requires a formal determination by the President or Congress. And the Army Court correctly noted President Biden's statements in 2021 ending the war in Afghanistan. As the Court explained, the Supreme Court explained in Granger, it is a movable date which can occur only 3 years after the date of termination of hostilities as proclaimed by the President or Congress. Relying upon its findings in Rivas Chivas that we were in a highly developed state of war in 2004 in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Army Court accurately accounted for this difference in the enemy as well as advances in technology. While noting that President Biden's statements that the war in Afghanistan had ended in April or August 21, the Court was correct in finding no formal declaration of the end of hostilities between 2014 and 16 to terminate the suspension. With the privilege of time, this Court can observe that the war in Afghanistan began on October 7, 2001, when combat operations began. If this Court would like, and I can supply this if it's helpful to the Court, that's the date that President Bush notified Congress in accordance with the War Powers Resolution, as well as notified the U.N. Security Council in accordance with Article 51, Self-Defense. Those are the dates that the administration provided as when combat operations began, and it is it was sanctioned through the 2001 AUMF. What we have as well for the termination clause is in the JA, page 344 through 48, which demonstrates that from 2014 to 2016, hostilities continued. Appellant does raise President Obama's statement in 2014 that combat operations had changed, had ended, and that the train advise assist mission was beginning. But we view that as a change in the mission set, not as a declaration of the end of hostilities. Because, in fact, when you look at the record, airstrikes continued. Our soldiers continued to be involved in firefights. They were subjected to suicide attacks. And while President Obama had set a troop ceiling, he later revised it to raise that ceiling and expanded commanders' authorities to engage in combat operations with our allies. And so ultimately, contemporary statements should be viewed with the understanding that it's based on imperfect knowledge, whereas the analysis for this provision is retrospective. We continue to have troops on the ground from 2014 to 2016, and this court need not determine the final date, because 2014 and 16 were clearly, we were still engaged in combat operations. But we would offer that the termination date would be August 31st of 2021 when we withdrew from Afghanistan. Pending any questions, save my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Major Nguyen. Captain Craig.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. This case centers around two primary issues that implicate both when and how the government brings forth charges. The Army Court correctly merged the domestic violence specifications. Decades of military jurisprudence dictate that a single continuous altercation constitutes one unit of prosecution. The government's attempt to parse a single fight into multiple convictions under different subsections of Article 128 Bravo contradicts this bedrock rule. Secondly, pursuant to RCM 907 Bravo 2 Bravo, the military judge's failure to advise Sergeant Askins about the statute of limitations and secure his express waiver was error, it was plain, and it was prejudicial.
So, Captain Creighton, based on your beginning there when you're saying that the Army CCA got this right, I'm going to ask you the same question I posed to government counsel. Is that really the issue before us? I understand that that's how TJAG framed it, but in fact, if we get past waiver, you concede in your brief that we're dealing with forfeiture. Shouldn't we then be applying plain error to the issue of what the military judge did rather than simply error by the CCA?
Yes, Your Honor. The motion for multiplicity was not made by defense counsel. It was not raised at trial, and so the failure to raise such a motion is presumed by this court and the RCMs to be forfeiture. So it places us in a plain error review.
So we are examining what the military judge did rather than the correctness of the CCA decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, how can the error be clear and obvious when we haven't had any case under 125 Bravo 1 and 125 Bravo 5? I mean, I think the argument that you made is that for decades we've always thought one continuous course of conduct, and that's certainly true for 128 offenses, but we just really haven't gotten a 128 Bravo type offense. Maybe there was an error, but why would it be clear and obvious if there's no precedent?
I would turn this court's attention to Henderson when it talks about whether or not the error was plain and obvious at trial, to your Honor's point, or if it becomes plain and obvious on appeal. And the Supreme Court in Henderson stated that should it become plain and obvious on appeal, it can be treated the same as whether it was plain or obvious at trial as well. And therefore, the appellant should not lose out on the benefit should this court finalize its precedent as to whether Article 128 Bravo can be treated as multiplicious.
But, counsel, that's the root of the question. If this court has not ruled on whether Bravo 1 and Bravo 5 are in fact similar, either the Blockberger or Forrester or some other analysis, then how is it plain and obvious? Even on appeal, how would it be plain and obvious? if there's no precedent?
It goes back to what the government, I believe, addressed as well as to the known right rather than whether or not the specifications are multiplicious in and of themselves. And appellant did not waive whether or not whether he did not raise the right to multiplicity. And so whether or not the underlying...
Go back through that sentence. Appellant did not raise or waive?
He did not waive. Apologies, okay. Your Honor. He did not waive the right to have the CCA or this court review whether these specifications are multiplicious.
Okay, but even, let's say, setting aside the issue of whether there's any precedent on this area, I was noting both in the briefs and then when Major Nguyen was explaining why, from the government's perspective, there was no problem here, that it's a very complicated area of the law. We have to take some from column A, some from column B, some from column C to come up with a conclusion. If we were to agree with your analysis, how, as a military judge, would that be clear or obvious that, in fact, he or she should have sua sponte ruled that it was multiplicious? It's not just a question of whether there's any precedent directly on point. You can also look at the complexity of the issue, can't you, and say, boy, plain error is a really tough hurdle for the defense to get over here.
It can be, Your Honor. In under RCM 907, it talks about this type of point where the taking of the evidence can happen before the military judge seeks to rule on a multiplicity motion. And as the government conceded, on its face, the charge sheet didn't necessarily contain multiplicious acts. But once we got through the taking of evidence, the victim in this case talked about two different strangulations in the course of a single continuous course of conduct, and that at that point should have raised to the judge that this could be an issue. But importantly in this case, Your Honors, the Army Court also analyzed for plain error. They did not find waiver. And when they analyzed for plain error, they also found at the end of the day that the military judge's findings were ambiguous, that it was the Army Court was unsure as to which strangulation constituted the predicate offense for the strangulation. And therefore, on those grounds, the Army Court correctly merged. So this court need not even reach the certified question to multiplicity. It can rest its decision on the same basis that the Army Court did, based on the ambiguous findings of the military judge.
So, counsel, just to sort of follow up on this, I think this court has found plain error on a novel issue because there was a provision in the UCMJ or in the rules that the lower courts seemed to disregard that should have been plain and obvious what they were supposed to do. There's no such provision that you're pointing to in this case that in the UCMJ or in the rules that would have dictated to the military judge or should have put the military judge on notice that they should have considered these specifications to be multiplicious?
Under the rules, no, Your Honor. But under this court's jurisprudence and how it has handled assaultive-type offenses, the military judge should have been on notice. And it goes to what my colleague across the aisle talked about, and that's congressional intent. And there simply is none here, whether express or implied. This Congress is presumed to know this court's jurisprudence and how it treats assaultive-type offenses. It placed nothing in its reports or in the statute specifically to indicate that this court should treat its analysis of multiplicity any differently than it has with assaultive offenses under Article 128. And so while these are different subsections of Article 128 Bravo, it is no different than how this court should examine assaultive offenses under 128. There is an offer type offense under Article 128. There's an aggravated assault type offense under Article 128. This court has historically merged those, and those are two different actus reus, as the government argues in its brief. So too in Article 128 Bravo, subsection 1 and subsection 5. Again, the congressional reports did not dictate anything to this court to change its analysis in regard specifically to multiplicity.
Counsel, could I ask you a question about a statement you just made that kind of stuck with me, and that is that the military judge should have known based upon, I think you were saying based upon the case law surrounding assault offenses, about the possibility of a multiplicity issue here without any knowledge of any of the evidence yet. Now, that strikes me that you might be suggesting that the military judge should know more about the case than the defense counsel does at that point. No?
No, Your Honor. I apologize if I misspoke. But
and I may have misheard you, too.
On the face of the charge sheet, no, Your Honor. The judge has not taken any facts at that point.
Okay. I understand.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Sergeant Askins contested his guilt at trial as to the domestic violence specifications. While he pled guilty to other charges, there was no express term in the plea agreement that any type of waiver applied to the contested portion of trial. Despite what the government now argues, this was a bifurcated trial.
I would say, counsel, and you're probably going to get there, so I apologize for if I'm cutting you off. But, yeah, it's unusual that contained within the plea agreement, you had the offenses that the accused was pleading to, and then you had sentence limitations on the offenses that were to be litigated. So what is this court to take by this from this combination within this plea agreement? I mean, government argues clearly by virtue of the fact that these litigated offenses were included in the plea agreement, then all the other terms of the plea agreement apply.
No, Your Honor, that simply isn't how the contract principles work. And so when we look at contract-type principles, what we are looking at is whether there are express terms. And it can be seen from the plea agreement itself that the parties contemplated exactly what they sought. And the only mention to the contested portion of the trial was the sentence cap that Your Honor is referencing. It did not say that the waive all waivables motion applied to all parts of trial. And parties were certainly, if they wanted to, able to write that into the contract, or rather the plea agreement, pardon me. But they did not do so. This court should not read into the plea agreement that such a all-encompassing provision should apply to the trial portions. It does not logically flow that Sergeant Askins would include such a provision to a contested portion of trial and therefore give up any motions that he could make at that contested portion, akin to any objections that he might make during trial as well. It would not be such.
Well, why not? I mean, he's gaining the benefit of the sentence cap. So it is a reasonable inference that in exchange for the benefit to the sentence cap, he's agreeing to these other restrictions and limitations or waivers.
I would disagree with Your Honor.
Okay.
It would be akin to going to trial with both your hands tied behind your back, and it would make defense counsel at that point a potted plant at defense table if indeed they are unable to make any motions to move the court whatsoever or make objections to anything that might come up. Defense counsel is not prescient. They do not know what could occur during the contested portion. And to read such an all-encompassing provision into the contested portion of trial, again, violates contractual principles and likely flies in the face of due process, because Sergeant Askins simply would not give up his ability to move the court in such a unique situation.
Why would I'm like Judge Johnson. I mean, why wouldn't you? I just don't understand how you can say what the counsel would or would not have done, because of trials across this nation all the time. Defense counsel always make these motions, whether their trials are contested, and they might later decide to plead guilty, or they've already decided to plead guilty, and they might later decide to contest some of the offenses. So I guess I'm stuck. Having once upon a time been a defense counsel, an age ago, I might admit, I'm not sure I follow you as to what my fellow defense counsels would or would not have done. You see what I'm griping about?
I do, Your Honor. And The bottom line is the parties were aware of what they could and could not bargain for.
Right.
The waive all waivables provision did not contain what really could have been a few extra words that said this also applies to the contested portion of trial. And to Judge Johnson's point about they knew what they were bargaining for, they talked about sentence limitations for those contested specifications, but that is the only thing they talked about for the contested portion itself.
But was that the meeting of the minds between the convening authority and the accused in the case?
Yes, Your Honor, because defense – we have plenty of record for that because the defense counsel continued to move the court and make objections. And so if indeed that had been the belief of all parties that Sergeant Askins could not move the court, the trial counsel should have immediately pulled out of the plea agreement.
I see. Okay.
So, counsel, I just want to be clear on this. I sort of thought you were going to argue that when you plead guilty to some specifications and decide to litigate others, that just severs the agreement and the plea agreement applies to the things you plead guilty to and just doesn't apply to the litigated offenses. But it sounds like and that might be a totally reasonable rule to have going forward. But it sounds like you're saying that's not the case because what I was going to ask you is if they had gone over the sentencing cap, I feel like you would have gone straight to the CCA and complained that they convening, you know, that you got more than you bargained for in the plea agreement. So I think you're saying now that the whole thing was in effect. It's just the waive all waivables has to be cabined to only the offenses that your client pled guilty to and not those that he chose to litigate. And we have to infer that from common sense, essentially. There's nothing in the agreement that would tell us that. It's just that it wouldn't make sense if you interpret it to mean he can't raise any objections, he can't file any motions during the litigated part of the proceedings. It just wouldn't make any sense. Is that essentially your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant is trying to suggest, acknowledging to this court that the defense counsel did bargain for a provision that was a part of the contested trial. So it is not, as Your Honor noted, what usually might occur, where the plea agreement is cabined solely to the specifications in which he does plead guilty and not to the contested portions. But certainly there was that provision. However, appellant rests on the notion that counsel were aware of what they could bargain for, and because there was not an express provision that said this waive all waivables provision applies to the contested portion as well, this court need not infer anything. It's simply that it does not exist within the four corners of the document. As this right was not waived, in a similar lack of expression, Congress provided neither an express nor an implied intent for this court to treat its analysis of Article 128 Bravo any differently than it has with assaultive 128-type offenses. The articles are similarly situated and cited. The inference is counter to what the government now argues, that this actually implies Congress meant for the articles to be treated similarly. Second, discussing cases such as Forrester, this court should not resolve ambiguity by turning a single transaction into multiple offenses. But importantly, and again, Your Honors can rely on the ambiguity of the military judge's findings in this case. This court cannot be sure which strangulation the military judge relied on, and therefore, the strangulation was multiplicious with the other corresponding violent offenses.
Counsel, can you explain why we have 128 Bravo 5? Why wouldn't that just be included in 1? Why would Congress make it separate?
The congressional reports that the government cited and appellant also referenced discuss strangulation as Congress's concern that under the old Article 128 auspices that the government was having trouble proving strangulation under an aggravated assault. And so when it sought to make Article 128 Bravo and make domestic violence different than 128, it also included strangulation and brought it out of that aggravated assault.
Doesn't that suggest exactly contrary to what you're saying now, though, which is that Congress sort of thought of them as two different offenses?
No, Your Honor. The The Supreme Court recently in Barrett noted that if Congress does not include Blockberger surmounting language, that this Court can still analyze and should analyze for multiplicity. Similar to how this Court has treated other 128 offenses, there are different subsections that include different actus reus, but they are still analyzed for multiplicity. And here, while the cleaner way for the government to charge strangulation is under Article 128 Bravo subsection 5, it still can charge it under 128 Bravo 1. And so in that sense, it could always apply to either subsection, and therefore it should always be analyzed for multiplicity. If Your Honors have any more questions on the multiplicity portion, turning to the time of war. Though Sergeant Askins pled guilty to the offense, plain error occurred and it prejudiced Sergeant Askins. First, the military judge received a charge sheet that on its face contained a specification with a charge timeline that fell well outside the 5-year statute of limitations. Pursuant to RCM 907 Bravo 2 Bravo, she had a sua sponte duty to advise Sergeant Askins and secure his express waiver of this bar to prosecution.
So if it's so plain in the face, on its face, then why didn't defense counsel raise it?
Your Honor, we are unsure of why defense counsel did not raise the issue. And I know you asked government about ineffective assistance of counsel. I assume that's where Your Honor is headed. The analysis for ineffective assistance of counsel is distinguished from whether or not the error occurred.
And well, we don't have to get into IAC claim because it wasn't raised. Point is, you're saying it's plain, clear on its face that there was this issue out there. Trial defense counsel didn't raise a motion, but in fact, trial defense counsel acknowledged that there was this statute of limitations issue floating around out there. Didn't that take the burden off the military judge under the rules at that point?
No, Your Honor.
And why is that?
The defense made a quick parenthetical to Rivas Chivas, buried inside of a 10-page motion that really was more focused on the ambiguity of the government's charging decision, where it was a 3-year time span, and the defense was also concerned that the C4 blocks that the government had charged could have also been taken at Fort Carson, which would have even more expanded the time frame. The citation to Rivas Chivas was merely a suggestion that defense counsel was unaware of the timeline in which the government was actually seeking to charge.
But counsel, he also cited, or because I don't know the gender of the defense counsel, cited Article 43. And so you say he made a passing reference to Rivas, but he cites Article 43 and argues that because of the ambiguity, that his client could be open to liability going back to 2011. So following on Chief Judge Olson's question, wouldn't it be reasonable for the military judge to then say, clearly, counsel and the accused are aware of the statute of limitation issues?
Absolutely, Your Honor, but she failed to do so. And so,
well, no, is not the requirement that the military judge must advise on statute of limitations if it appears that the accused is unaware. And clearly from the motion to dismiss, the accused was aware of statute of limitation issues.
Rivas Chivas might give the citation to Rivas Chivas might give the military judge an indicia. But she did not mention the statute of limitations in her ruling. So it appears that the military judge did not take into account whether the statute of limitations applied. She provided no findings of fact or conclusions of law as to whether it did apply or not.
That would go to the deference that we would afford the military judge's ruling.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. But it simply is not there on the record.
And where is the burden placed on her to do that?
Because the wording of 907, it says it has a sua sponte duty on the military judge.
But only if there is a reasonable belief that trial defense counsel is not aware of the issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as Judge Johnson is pointing out, it's not just Rivas Chivas. It's more to it that indicates that there's The defense counsel knew there's no there was a statute of limitations issue out there, and to beat a dead horse, because there's no IAC claim, we are assuming that defense counsel was competent here. So why did the military judge have any requirement to do anything here?
Your Honor, Article 43, and if I may briefly talk about the context of Article 43, Fox, and I think that that'll shed some light on this answer, Your Honor, is that historically 43, Fox came about because Congress wanted to be able to prosecute these types of larcenies and frauds against the government in a whole of government movement towards war. When the exigencies of war meant that the government could not prosecute what essentially are these simple type crimes. That means that the Article 43 Fox exception, the suspension of the statute of limitations, is much different than the other subsections found in Article 43. And 43, Article 43 talks about the 5-year statute of limitations and how that normally applies. And then except for Article 43 Fox, which, as Your Honors know, suspends the statute of limitations in a time of war. The parties did not litigate. It was not clear from the face of defense's motion nor any reference from the military judge whether the parties believed the United States was at war during this time frame and therefore whether the statute of limitations would have been suspended. Going back, on its face, the charge sheet contained a specification that was outside the statute of limitations, the 5-year bar. But should we have been at a time of war, during that time period, then that was an issue that should have been litigated at trial, and it was not. And the Army Corps took it upon itself to conduct an analysis of whether it believed we were at war. But it failed to take in the historical context of Article 43 Fox and whether that applied. And it had nothing from the trial court as to whether the parties all agreed or understood that this extreme exception applied.
Counsel, on the lack of evidence, the Army Corps relied in part, not in whole, but in part on President Biden's statements. Would it be appropriate to just take judicial notice and defer to the President on an issue like that?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't see any reason to not take judicial notice of that. However, Article 43 Fox, as just mentioned, requires a much more strict interpretation. It is not the time of war that this Court has contemplated through numerous cases over the last few decades. But when it looks to cases involving AWOL and desertion, for instance, that interpretation of time of war is much more focused on the soldier and whether or not the government has the ability, a carrot and stick ability to punish that soldier for the crimes. 43 Fox is far different. It is a time bar. It places the onus on the government. It is a complete bar to prosecution, except for this unique exigency where the United States is at war. And so it really requires a much more strict interpretation, not just whether the president declared an end to hostilities. It requires a much more holistic view. We simply were not at war as contemplated by the statute when we were in Afghanistan.
But don't we have 70 years of precedent saying that we consider both de jure at war and de facto at war?
Yes, Your Honor. The last time that this exception, 43 Fox, was notated by this court was back in the 1950s under, I believe it was, Swain. And that was the last time that this court addressed this particular exception, and for good reason. When Congress implemented the Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act, and then quite quickly after it, Article 43 Fox, it was on the heels of World War II and as we were gearing up for Korea. There we had millions of soldiers and troops deployed overseas. We were fully at war. And when I mean fully, not only the military-industrial complex, but the civilian complex as well, was all in singular movement towards the prosecution of war. Similarly in Korea, and millions of soldiers overseas, we still had a draft. And since that time, this particular subsection has not been used or litigated for quite good reason. Even over the last 25 years, as we've been in Afghanistan and Iraq and fighting counterinsurgency operations across the world, that is not the total prosecution of war that Congress envisioned when it created this statute. And so we absolutely agree with the government that there were soldiers on ground, that we were still taking casualties, and as the Army Court also noted, that there were appropriations being given to these operations. But that does not properly account for the context of how this article, when and how this article came about.
But given that this issue wasn't litigated, and how would a military judge know that you think he ought to deviate from 70 years of military court precedents, not recent precedent from this court, but the CCA's had more recent precedents. Why would they think, oh, we now need a new test in 2025, we now need a new test that deviates from the sort of de facto war test we've been applying for decades, since Korea?
Apologies, Your Honor, if I suggested that we needed a new test. Certainly not. I'm not suggesting that we shy away from Bancroft or any of the exhaustive factors. What appellant is saying is that those factors, the few that the Army Court cited without any actual citations to those, was not enough to constitute at war that is contemplated by 43 Fox. It is not time of war as this Court has contemplated when it looks at AWOL or desertion type cases. It is a much more confined universe. Also, Congress amended the civilian statute in 2008. So for 60 years, Congress allowed these two exact same wording statutes to run. Your Honor, I see my time is about to expire.
You may conclude your sentence there.
Thank you. Congress let these two statutes run the exact same for nearly 60 years and then chose to amend the civilian statute, which broadened the scope of what civilian courts could contemplate constituted war, and it allowed for the authorizations for use of military force and contingency operations. It did not do so with Article 43 Fox, meaning that this court's strict interpretation of at war under that exception should still apply.
Are there any further questions from the bench? If you choose, you may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. The military judge erred by not securing Sergeant Askin's waiver of the time-barred larceny, and the Army Court further erred by holding the statute of limitations was suspended. This Court should set aside the affected specification. As well, this Court should affirm the merger of the domestic violence specifications. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Captain Crane. Major Nguyen.
Your Honor, to your question, Judge Maggs, your question about why Congress created 128B5 strangulation, the reports indicated that Congress wanted to deter indicators of future lethal violence. They were concerned with the escalation in violence in domestic relationships. So that is why we believe it was an independent section of that statute. To your question as to who has the burden of proof, of course, it's ordinarily on the moving party, and because in this case there was none, it makes it a little bit more difficult. I would like to address the discussion about the historical context of Article 43F. Article 43F and its civilian equivalent was passed in 1942, and it changed the language of the existing exception where it gave a date finite of 1946 and changed it to a moving date as 3 years after the termination of hostilities as declared by the President. And Congress at the time could not have known that World War II would end 3 years later. And so the fact that it appears that the crux of the issue is that the Afghanistan war was 20 years is what defense is concerned with, but it is still within congressional intent with that moving date. And if we look to the question of judicial notice, the cases dealing with Korea and Vietnam did take judicial notice of actions such as, for Vietnam, it was the start of the war was the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, and the end of cessation of hostilities was the Paris Peace Accords, in which it indicated total cessation of hostilities. Similarly, for Korea, the courts looked to, they relied, Bancroft, Ayers, and Taylor actually relied on a U.S. Army Anderson case where they noted that Congress had created tax benefits for the combat area of Korea and that there was similarly an executive order that the president designated as a combat zone. So we have the exact same situation here in Afghanistan. We do have, and I can again provide this to the court if it's helpful, we have Afghanistan designated as a combat zone per Executive Order 13119 on September 19, 2001. We have close to 300 awards related to heroism in combat against an armed enemy as well. And again, admittedly, we do have the Doha Peace Agreement in February of 2020, but the language in that agreement does not mention cessation of hostilities in contrast to the Paris Peace Accords and the Korean Armistice. So these are all documents that can be properly taken judicial notice of.
Counsel, how about the National Defense Service Medal? I think you have one. Is that is that relevant?
Yes, it's all an indication of what the whole of government effort was. Specifically, the awards that I address are with respect to combat, because the question of time of war is related to that, was the Presidential Unit Citation, the Valorous Unit Award, and the Meritorious Unit Citation. We had close to 300 of those awards during 2014 to 2017. And so what was the government engaged in those years? It was continued combat actions. Lastly, I see my time has expired. If I could.
You may briefly address the plain error issue.
For the plain error issue, there was at least 5 months that were not told. And also, the military judge realized that there were 11 explosives drawn from 5 specific lot draws between the 2014 to 2017. Had he not pled guilty, the government would have probably proven intent to permanently deprive when he shipped in 2017. So the Providence inquiry only addressed one explosive. And so, at the very least, it wasn't plain on its face when it came to the Providence inquiry.
Okay, I see your time has expired. Any questions from the bench? You may briefly conclude if you wish.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Ultimately, appellant's position is that there were not enough casualties, not enough loss, not enough devotion. But as President Biden said on August 31st, 2021, there is no such thing as a low-cost, low-grade, low-risk when it is about war. We ask that this court vacate with respect to multiplicity and affirm with respect to the time of war.
Thank you, Major Nguyen. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:45.
Court stands in recess until 10:45.